Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Inside the Issue. As today we talk about the integration of antibody-drug conjugates into the management of hormone receptor positive and triple negative breast cancer, as we say, ADCs made easy. Just kidding. We'll be tough getting through this in an hour. We have a great faculty today to discuss this. Professor Peter Schmid from the Bard Cancer Institute in London, and Dr. Sarah Tulaney from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. We recruited four other investigators, including Dr. Tulaney's colleague, Dr. Burstein, to participate in a survey, and we'll show you the results of that, detailing their usual treatment approaches. As always, if you have any cases or questions you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room, and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As in all of our webinars, there's a one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey in the chat room. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of this meeting. We know a lot of people end up listening to our programs. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program on triple-negative breast cancer with Drs. Kalinske and MacArthur. Tomorrow, we're going to do a really great another webinar on ALK-targeted therapy, particularly looking at the adjuvant ALINA trial. And then we're going to be taking a break from webinars for a few weeks. We'll be back in August looking at HER2 targeted strategies in the management of GI cancer. There's lots to talk about there, not just T-DXd, but also tucatinib, trastuzumab as well. On August 29th, we'll be talking about neuroendocrine tumors. That's a great opportunity, something we don't talk about very often. We'll be going to the SOHO meeting this year and doing several programs, one on CAR T therapy, non-Hodgkin lymphoma and CLL, and also current management of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. But today we're here to talk about ADCs and these two subsets of breast cancer. I guess we should say now we have a whole bunch of other subsets of HER2 low, HER2 ultra low, and beyond. As in all of our programs, we will be talking about the use of unapproved agents and regimens, so check the package inserts for more information. As we do in all this series, I met with each one of the faculty to record a presentation and an interview. These are posted in the chat room, but we'll also send it out along with the replay of this program. And really, this is, should be really integrated together. These are great presentations. Sarah reviewed TROP2-directed ADCs. Peter talked about other non-TROP2, particularly, of course, T-DXd and so much going on there. I really recommend you check out those presentations. But we pulled some of the slides, and we're going to talk about some of the concepts that came out there. And here's what where we're heading today. We're going to just start out talking about ADCs in general, and in particular as it relates to metastatic breast cancer. Pharmacology, and particularly what we hear more and more discussion about sequencing of ADCs. And then we'll look at some of the content that Sarah went through specifically about TROP2-directed ADCs. There are three of them nowadays, one approved. And then we'll go through Peter's review of other ADCs, including T-DXd. So maybe we could just start out kind of with some basics here, Sarah. I just review for our audience basically what we thought an ADC is. I think our concept is evolving as we see. You were telling me one of the, I think actually Peter was saying that it's a big mistake to group all ADCs together like they're all kind of separate. But what's your vision, Sarah, about how these agents work?
Well, I think you bring up a good point, how we think they work and how they actually work may be a little different. But I think what we think is going on is that, we've been able to identify targets on a cancer cell. And if we could use an antibody that's directed towards that target and that antibody is linked to chemotherapy, then the idea would be that that antibody binds to the target, that whole ADC gets taken into the cancer cell, you get release of the chemo or the payload, as we call it, off the ADC in the cancer cell, it kills the cancer cell, and then with some antibody drug conjugates, that payload is cell membrane permeable and can get through the membrane, get into the neighbor. So if it kills the neighboring cancer cell, then that's what we call its function via bystander effect. And so, the beauty of this is that we can get a lot of chemotherapy delivered in a targeted way into a cancer cell and really result in very robust efficacy. So I think a very clever idea, but there are lots of nuances, I think, to the actual mechanism.
So let's start to get into some of those nuances. And Peter really gets into it with his talk. So we'll give you a little taste of it. Really ought to check out the talk to get all the details. So Peter, now what are we looking at? And you have another slide here about the, I wasn't even aware people visualize this as different generations of ADC now, you know, now in our third generation, and we'll come to that in a second. But I guess one of the key issues here is the target and target expression, Peter. Can you talk a little bit about sort of where we are with the new antibody drug conjugates and how you visualize their mechanisms?
Yeah, it's a really important question. And Sarah already mentioned the bystander effect. And I think when it sort of initially came into the discussion, many of us thought this may just be a marketing thing. But actually, I truly believe the bystander effect is one of the key drivers of the superior efficacy we see with the current generation of ADCs compared to the previous generation. And it's very clear if you have no bystander effect, you predominantly target cells that have the actual target for the ADC. But we know that the expression of targets is heterogeneous. We know the expression is sometimes low. And so with the bystander effect, we have the unique ability not just to take out the target positive cells, but also the target negative cells. And how effective this is, recent studies have shown that, well, even with something called ultra low expression, where literally just a few cells out of 100, we have a little bit of the target there. That seems to be enough to drive the efficacy of those drugs. I think that is a key determinant of the success.
So again, getting back to this idea of different generations, maybe you can kind of talk a little bit about your vision about sort of what the difference is between second and third generation, which is what we're on now, and then where we're heading as we develop new agents.
But in a nutshell, all ADCs have three components. It's an antibody, there's a linker that glues then as a third component, the payload to the antibody. And throughout the generations, improvements have been made in each of those three components. Between the second and third generations, the antibodies got better. The payloads are a little bit more potent, but also the linker technology has been improved. And as a result, we have a higher efficacy, even if there's relatively low target expression. And we have also a bit less off-target toxicity. The bystander effect is something that really has really come into play in the third generation. And that's, for me, one of the key differences. And if you look at the head-to-head comparison, for example, of HER2 second-generation ADC T-DM1 and third-generation ADC T-DXd, you see a almost dramatically higher activity. And that's not just down to the antibody.
So, and this is another graphic you put out that I think is really instructive, focusing on, I guess, the target. Can you kind of explain this and where we're heading in terms of that?
Yeah, so the second generation ADCs obviously worked well, but in order to work, because they didn't have a strong bystander effect, they needed homogeneous and high target expression. And that's why we know if you look at T-DM1, it really only worked in HER2 high disease, but it didn't really work in HER2 low disease. When we came to the third generations, the initial studies showed that it works in heterogeneous and in low target expression. And the most recent data from DESTINY-Breast06 show that even in ultra low expression, so less than 10% of the cells having patchy expression of the target, that's enough to drive a benefit. But there's still some theoretical considerations whether the distribution of the positive versus the negative cells make a difference. And what I tried to illustrate here, if you have a cluster of positive cells with a huge bridge and surrounding area of negative cells, is that a pattern where the treatment still works? Or do you have to have positive and negative cells almost interdispersed to have that optimal benefit? I think it's not just a percentage of cells we will probably look into in the future, but also the type of distribution.
So I want to say to Venue in the chat room that I see your case of a 41-year-old woman who's 16 weeks pregnant. It looks like you could use a second or third opinion there. So we'll get to that before the end of this and hopefully give you a little assistance. But Sarah, you know, we have a bunch of ADCs available, and HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer, clearly TDXD and HER2 low, ultra low and beyond, sacituzumab as well, and then others coming on. But again, one of the questions whenever we talk about ADCs, whether it's lung cancer or anywhere else, this always comes up sequencing. Just like with chemotherapy, you know, you wouldn't use an anthracycline after anthracycline or taxane after taxane. But how do we apply that here? And Sarah, you had a really great graphic that just really point out the challenges here. Would you like to discuss it?
Yeah, it is currently a big question in the breast cancer world. Is should we be sequencing one ADC and after another? And the challenge is, you know, all the registration trials that we have done to date really didn't have patients in them who had a prior ADC. And so we don't really understand efficacy in a robust way for how these agents are working one after another. And the question that arises is really due to what is the mechanism of resistance to the ADC, because that would help us understand if another one is going to work. And I think the way, at least I've broken it down in my head very simplistically, is, you know, one would think resistance is either because something happened to the target, maybe the target went away, maybe there's a mutation in the target, or something happened with lysosomal processing, so internalization of that ADC, or something happened with resistance to the chemo, so you have payload resistance, right? And so right now in breast cancer, our two ADCs that we have are TDXD or sacituzumab govitecan. While both of these have different targets, their payloads are both topoisomerase 1 inhibitors. And so one would think if the mechanism of resistance to one ADC is payload resistance, are these payloads so similar that in fact you would lead to having resistance to the second ADC? Whereas if it's target resistance, you would think that, well, these ADCs should work one after the other. And I think what we're learning from limited data from a lot of retrospective series is that resistance can happen in any of those ways, can even see both occurring in one patient. And there may be other mechanisms that we don't understand, because sometimes we see one work, the next one doesn't. Sometimes we see one doesn't work, the next one does. And I think this is a challenge that we're facing in the clinic. But in general, it seems like the second ADC isn't working quite as well as the first. So we are seeing, in general, more limited efficacy with second exposure, but not uniformly the case.
So we just had our first question in the chat room about IOs and ADCs, but we'll get to that in a second. And getting back to Sarah's comments on sequencing, I'll refer you to Peter's talk where he kind of gets into the same thing with this slide, but I'm not going to let him talk about it right now because Sarah just commented. But here's my way of looking at it, which is very practical. I hear you all talking about this stuff. What I want to know is, what are you doing? And you know, when everybody does the same thing, that's when we call it a consensus. I'm not so sure this is a consensus, other than the fact that in general, all of our faculty are open to the idea of using two ADCs in a row. However, half of the faculty don't really like the idea very much of using two ADCs in a row with the same target. And then another half of the faculty, actually sort of different, two out of three different, don't really like the idea of using the same payload. I guess that just reflects the empirical nature of where we are now. Any thoughts, Peter?
I think ultimately we have two ADCs sort of in clinical practice in triple negative disease and HER2 positive disease, and they have the same class payload and a different target, and I would happily use them after each other. I think in reality the activity probably goes down, I would say, to a third of what we would see if we haven't given an ADC before, but there's still activity there. Now, ideally, what you would like to have is an ADC with a different payload and a different target. But in reality, that's what we don't have at the moment. And so I think what we desperately need, in my opinion, is more ADCs with different payloads. But in the absence of that, I use what I have. And so I very happily use SG after TDXD to spell it out by name. So TDXD after SG. It will get a little bit more complex when you have a second TROP2 target ADC coming through. And I think that we need to think a bit more carefully. I think psychologically it feels good if you at least change one of the components. If you then have same target and same class of payload, it probably isn't going to be very different to changing the target, but psychologically it probably feels a little bit different at the moment.
So there's another Doc Uzoma trying to get us to talk about a HER2 positive patient who didn't respond to neoadjuvant TCHP. Sounds like she could use some help too. So we'll try to get to that case too. Incidentally, Peter was telling me that he no longer calls it, you don't call it HER2 positive, you call it HER2 high, Peter. Like HER2 high is the new HER2 positive.
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? Because what is HER2 positive? HER2 positive was defined by the benefit of trastuzumab therapy. But of course, there's a little bit more behind there, that what we call HER2 positive is where HER2 seems to be the oncogenic driver. But I think it is tricky from an ADC point of view. I think it's high expression and low expression. From an oncogenic driver point of view, of course, it's very clearly different whether you have HER2 positive disease or HER2 negative disease with low expression.
Yeah, we're just trying to explain it to all the people outside of breast cancer, the investigators, because they know less about it than, you know, general medical oncologists. And getting into the issue of sequencing, we could spend a half an hour on this. You know, check out the slides. We have all kinds of scenarios that we presented. Sarah, here's one. You know, we're looking at ER positive. We're saying HER2 negative, period, IHC zero. And question is, what comes, if you're going to give capecitabine after endocrine therapy, and we'll talk about whether or not you want to use an ADC before capecitabine. But if you're going to use, if the patient has had capecitabine in the ER positive situation, interestingly, most people, well, not interesting, obviously, these people go with sacituzumab. But then when we say same case, HER2 low, TDXD. Any thoughts, Sarah? And also, do you sort of adapt this if you have a HER2 low to whether the patient needs a response, whether there's visceral disease, et cetera, or just TDXD for everybody?
I will say I think it's getting more and more complicated because even with these questions, I actually thought it was complicated because it depends what you mean by HER2 zero. Because if we count HER2 zero as including HER2 ultra low, I've differentiated HER2 zero now into HER2 null, meaning they've got absolutely no HER2 expression, or HER2 ultra low, where they have 1 to 10% faint staining. So not quite a 1 plus, but not a null. And so if you went back to that question that was ER positive HER2 zero, I think my question to that was, well, what do you mean by HER2 zero? Because now I think we're going to want to know, was it ultra low? Because if it was ultra low, then maybe our answers would have been a little different, where we would have considered TDXD potentially instead of sacituzumab and some of those answers that you saw. Whereas in this case, this patient is clearly HER2 low and has already had a line of chemotherapy. And given data that we've now seen from both DESTINY-Breast04, which would support use of TDXD here, as well as DESTINY-Breast06, which supported TDXD in the first line setting, I think it becomes the natural choice. And I would say to your question, I usually use it in almost all patients post capecitabine. You know, I think it was more robust when compared head-to-head to taxane in DB06. And so I think it gives me some comfort in thinking it's probably from an efficacy standpoint superior. And if you're trying to make a decision between IV chemo, I probably would pick the TDXD in this setting.
So I kind of want to get moving on here because we got so many other things to talk about. But audience, check out the in the presentation that Sarah did, we actually got into the issue of ER low. We won't even get into that now, but that's actually pretty interesting. So Peter, what about triple negative? So straightforward triple negative, not too much question about what happens after anthracycline taxane. You got great data with sacituzumab. But then when you have HER2 low, we've seen this right from the day the HER2 low data DESTINY-04 was presented, which people still prefer sacituzumab in the triple negative HER2 low situation before TDXD. Any thoughts, Peter?
I think I wouldn't look at it as a reflection of the efficacy of one drug over the other. It's more a reflection of the evidence we have. And we have a large randomized phase 3 trial just focusing on triple negative breast cancer with sacituzumab. And we have a subgroup of patients of around 60 patients who were treated with TDXD. Now, the signal in the triple negative patients with TDXD was very comparable to the signal in patients with ER positive disease. And so I think we still have very impressive activity. But I would at the moment for TNBC choose the drug where I have slightly more data. And that would be my first choice. And I think everyone else felt the same way. That's why sort of unanimously sacituzumab govitecan was chosen as the first option. But as I said, that's a reflection of the data, the amount of data, the quality of data, not actually of the efficacy.
So, Peter, we're all waiting to see the survival data from Keynote 522, hopefully in the next few months, hopefully. But and I know we're not talking about that, but Hassan in the chat room has a case real quick. Curious what you think. Triple negative breast cancer, 3 centimeter primary, TILs, negative nodes by MRI and ultrasound, mammography. How would you approach neoadjuvant therapy in this patient?
So I think it's very clear that patients with stage 2 or stage 3 disease should be considered for neoadjuvant therapy. And I think it's very clear that they should these days, unless there's a clear contraindication, be considered for a combination of chemotherapy and immune therapy. And that's based on a significant improvement in event-free survival. And many of you may have seen the press release now also in overall survival, although the data obviously are not yet in the public domain. What's really interesting, and we often have clinically discussion, well, this is just a T2NO patient. Do they really need chemotherapy and immune therapy? Well, we presented all the different subgroups, whether it's N0, whether it's T2N0, whether it's stage 2, they all have a very similar, possibly even a bigger benefit of immune therapy. The hazard ratio was certainly almost better in the lower risk group patients. And the delta, the absolute benefit in terms of event-free survival is between 8 and 10% in those groups. So I think in terms of clinical parameters, if you meet the criteria for Keynote 522, and that's a tumor of 2 centimeters or larger and or lymph node positive, then I would always consider neoadjuvant chemotherapy as per the 522 regimen plus immune therapy.
So we're really looking forward to seeing those survival data. Let's talk about TROP2 ADC. Sarah, you go through this in your talk. Can you talk a little bit about what TROP2 is, where we see it, and the relationship, if any, to treatment benefit for sacituzumab govitecan?
Yeah, so we know that TROP2 is expressed very commonly in breast cancer, actually really across all the subtypes of breast cancer. More than 90% of tumors will have TROP2, at least some level of TROP2 expression. And so it becomes a really nice target for an ADC because it's seen on the cancer cell and not so much on normal cells, and so gives you a nice way to deliver chemotherapy. The question, though, that you bring up is a good one is, does the degree of TROP2 expression impact the efficacy to sacituzumab govitecan? Since it's targeting TROP2, one would think, well, you're likely to have more efficacy if you've got a lot of TROP2 there. And so this was looked at both in the ASCENT trial, the registration trial in triple negative disease, as well as in TROPICS-02, which was the registration trial in hormone receptor positive disease. And generally what you saw is, irrespective of TROP2 expression, sacituzumab always did better than chemo, whether you were TROP2 low or TROP2 high. But what you do see, which I think is intriguing, is as TROP2 expression increases, your absolute progression-free survival, which was, I think, very nicely seen in ASCENT, was longer. And so it does seem like as TROP2 expression is higher, you are probably going to have a longer benefit from treatment with a TROP2-directed ADC.
Yeah, I found that really interesting. I hadn't heard that myself before. So, Peter, we have one approved and 2 other TROP2-directed agents now in investigation. Any thoughts where this is going to end up in the next few years before we get into what we know at this point?
Well, I think what is very clear is that TROP2 targeting ADCs already play a role and will play a substantial role in the treatment of ER-positive and triple-negative breast cancer. I think we will see some of these drugs moving into earlier lines. I think many of us feel that the first-line studies have a very good chance of being positive. I expect a lot from the interaction between IO and ADC, and I'm really intrigued to see there whether that may possibly widen the indication for immune therapy. And we will hopefully see some of those agents move into the early disease setting. I think with the lowest hanging fruit probably being the post-neoadjuvant setting and triple negative breast cancer, where I'm personally convinced that TROP2 targeted ADCs will be better than our current standard with capecitabine and pembrolizumab, because capecitabine is just not a very effective drug. How it pans out ADC1 against ADC2 against ADC3. I don't think we will see those studies happening. I don't think they are necessarily our priority to compare A, B, and C. But I think each of those drugs may opt for a slightly different niche, and we will probably see more than one drug being approved. And then over time, we will work out whether there are some subgroups where one drug may be a little bit better than the other. I think some of this will also pan out in terms of the safety profile, which are distinctly different from what we know at the moment with, for example, SG or Dato-DXd.
So speaking of IO and ADC, I think the same day that we recorded Peter's interview, we did a webinar with his colleague there down the hall, Tom Powles, and, you know, IO, ADC, first line therapy, bladder cancer, Tom's like going to Time Magazine, et cetera. But everybody is looking at that, and that beat cisplatin first line. So I think it got a lot of attention. And maybe that's where some of these ADCs are heading. But let's talk about where we are right now, starting out with the phase three ASCENT trial. Can you kind of summarize the bottom line there, Sarah?
Yeah, the bottom line with ASCENT is that when sacituzumab was compared to treatment of physician's choice chemotherapy in patients who had pretreated metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, in essence, sacituzumab did better in terms of both progression-free survival and overall survival, in essence, doubling overall survival. And so really, in my mind, has established sacituzumab as standard of care in the second line and beyond metastatic triple-negative setting.
And here, of course, are the PFS and survival data. Can you talk a little bit about what was seen there and what you see clinically in terms of tolerability? Obviously, the two big issues there being neutropenia and diarrhea.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is really important to know when you use sacituzumab that neutropenia is very common. So about half of your patients are going to get high-grade neutropenia. And most of these patients will require growth factor utilization. So about 50% of patients in the ASCENT trial ended up on growth factor. And when you use it, it does keep people on schedule. So I think really important to be aware of. The diarrhea, on the other hand, is usually low grade. And so most of my patients will do fine with just as needed loperamide. And I feel like that helps control it well. And I think the other thing I just to make people aware of is that everyone pretty much goes bald when you give them sacituzumab. So if they have hair, it is important to counsel them that they will lose their hair with this agent.
So, Peter, in terms of management of cytopenias, I'm kind of curious. Here's a scenario for you. Patient comes in, cycle four of SG, day one, has an absolute neutrophil count of, let's say, 11, 1200. What do you do with the next cycle?
I mean, I think that's just, it depends on how fragile the patient is, how much you're under pressure in terms of the treatment. So if you have a patient where you think she is at high risk of having neutropenic complications, and actually it's lower amount of disease and you're not with the back to the wall, you may be better off waiting a few days. In theory, you can treat on day one with an ANC of 1.2. But I think it comes down to the patient. What we tend to do is much more primary G-CSF prophylaxis these days. And I think more and more centers are adopting this. Initially, it was secondary prophylaxis, but I think it just reduces the risk of infection, as Sarah said, but also keeps us on schedule just a little bit better as well. One of the things I find really remarkable, and I don't know whether Sarah shared the same, I feel we have had a huge learning curve, steep learning curve with those drugs. And not just with SG, you could say the same about TDXD. And the tolerability these days in clinical practice is much better than in the initial registrational studies. For example, as Sarah mentioned, we don't really see diarrhea anymore. It's very well managed. It's not a limiting factor and a factor with a huge negative impact on quality of life for patients on SG. And we have, again, with primary prophylaxis with GCSF, we have very little trouble there as well.
So, Sarah, here's a trial, ASCENT-03, looking at sacituzumab in PD-1 negative patients in metastatic triple negative breast cancer. Any thoughts about where that's going to land?
Yeah, I mean, I think now that sacituzumab is an established second line, obviously we're very interested in seeing if it can become a first line therapy because it's doing better than chemo. It makes you think it's better than standard chemo. So my guess is ASCENT-03 will probably be a positive study. It's completed accrual, so hopefully we'll see data in the not too distant future.
Go ahead.
So if you look at the, I mean, obviously TNBC totally different to the positive disease, but if you look at DESTINY-Breast06 versus DESTINY-Breast04, and yes, I think what is impressive is always these high response rates with ADCs, but also that those response rates are still very high in a second and third line setting. And if you look at the delta in terms of PFS, almost the first line and the second, third line study, that's almost identical. So if you take first line and second line treatment sequentially, you may not actually have such a big difference. So I agree with you that I'm excited about seeing these drugs moving into the first line setting. Having said that, I would love to see proper sequencing study, first line versus followed by second line versus second line followed by first line, and see which sequence is ultimately providing optimal patient benefit.
Yeah, including patient-reported outcomes. I think that'll be pretty interesting. All right, Sarah, what about an ER-positive, HER2-negative disease, TROPiCS-02?
So this study was for patients who had pretreated metastatic hormone receptor-positive disease, so they had to have had 2 to 4 lines of prior chemotherapy in the metastatic setting and have progressed on a CDK4/6 inhibitor and a taxane. So very heavily pretreated population, and sacituzumab was compared to treatment of physician's choice chemo. And you saw that there was an improvement in progression-free survival, as well as a significant improvement, about a 3-month delta in terms of overall survival. So I think where we think about sacituzumab and metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer has been predominantly in the second line or later for in terms of lines of chemotherapy. So if someone, for example, was not a candidate for T-DXd, maybe was not a HER2-low patient, you would think about sacituzumab after a line of standard chemotherapy for metastatic disease, or you would think about it post-T-DXd in someone who had HER2-low disease.
So this is a study I sure would like to see the results for. Would you like to comment on it?
Yeah, so ASCENT-07 is, you know, since we just said sacituzumab is currently what we think of as a second line chemo for metastatic ER-positive disease, obviously there's interest in seeing if it could replace first line chemo. And so this is ASCENT-07, which is currently accruing, really comparing sacituzumab to standard chemo. I think the challenge is that, you know, this is a trial that is irrespective of HER2-low status. So if you're HER2-low or HER2-0, you could go on to this study. I would say in the United States, most of these patients now post-DB06 are going to be getting T-DXd in this setting. And so I think it has a high bar to think about whether or not we'd actually move towards utilizing sacituzumab first line when we saw, you know, such a robust benefit in DB06.
Although there is a little ILD there and also in DB06, Peter, I think it was like about 11%. And most of it, at least as what they reported, was grade 2 or greater. So I guess, does that enter into your decision? I mean, you have patients maybe, smoking history or lung mets, or does that alter your thoughts about using T-DXd, for example, if we do end up in a situation where we might have a choice?
I think you're right. I mean, I think there's a small percentage of patients where you have relative or absolute contraindications for the use of trastuzumab deruxtecan with, for example, pre-existing interstitial lung damage and prior pneumonitis. But in reality, I think most patients can be considered for treatment with trastuzumab deruxtecan. And I think if you apply the recommended monitoring strategies, and that is to do regular CT scans of the lung. We can discuss the frequency, but most people would say probably around 9 weeks or 9 to 12 weeks is probably still acceptable. Then there's a good chance that if ILD occurs, that you discover it at a relatively early stage. And I think that's important, early stage, early intervention. Important for two reasons. One, it doesn't go to significant toxicity. And one of the interesting observations, you see very little grade 4 events with just as what Dirk's again. You see grade 1, you see grade 2, you see grade 3, and you see very occasionally grade 5 events. So what I would interpret from there is if it gets to severe events, it's very difficult to manage them. And unfortunately, we still lose a very small percentage of patients to this toxicity. So early detection, early intervention is key. And that means pausing the drug, possibly considering steroids. But when it gets to grade 2 and grade 3, then we also do not re-expose patients to the drug.
So a couple questions in the chat room. Back to you, Sarah. Bertha wants to know, when you use pegfilgrastim, you use day 1 and day 8 or just day 8? Shoba wants to know, any data on SASE given day 1 and 15 out of Q28?
Yeah, those are really good questions. It's complicated when you're giving a drug on day 1 and day 8 because you can't give a long-acting growth factor on day 2 because it would be then overlapping with your administration on day 8. So I think what most of us have turned to do is either we give long-acting pegfilgrastim on day 9. So either you can use the on-body formulation and put it on them on day 8 so it releases on day 9 and see if that keeps them controlled. There are some patients, though, who aren't sufficiently controlled with just the day 9 dose. And so in those patients, I'll use short-acting G-CSF on days 2, 3, and 4. So that way they're covered on days 2, 3, 4, and then on day 9. So that becomes a little bit complicated. I do try to stick, however, with the day 1 and day 8 schedule. We have very limited data on trying to switch the schedule up to every other week or every 3 weeks. And so I do stick with day 1 and day 8.
So, Peter, I'd like to hear what you think about this case of Sarah's. It's funny because nowadays you got to ask when people were treated because they were treated 3 years ago. It's completely different. But anyhow, if I remember correctly, this is, you guys in Dana-Farber, you get all the really well-read patients. This patient came in and had a high TMB of 11 and 12 and wanted an IO. So you actually had a trial of SASE plus or minus IO, right? But she, unfortunately, at least according to her, got randomized to just SASE alone, although it sounds like she did really well. Anything you want to say to Peter about this case?
Yeah, no, I will say, Peter, we debated about this patient a lot because she had progressed her endocrine therapy and had one line of chemo. So she got capecitabine, which she did great on. But then she was also HER2 low. So I could have given her TDXD as her next line post capecitabine, but she also had a high TMB. And so there was interest in seeing, should we get her immunotherapy? And generally I like to give the immunotherapy earlier rather than later. And so we thought we'd take our chances on the SASE IO trial, but she was not happy when she got randomized to not get the immunotherapy. But again, as was noted, she did have a great response and was on study for quite a long time. But I'm curious how you would think about a case of someone who's HER2 low, but also high TMB.
It was only 11 or 12, right? It was like 11. Was it biopsy?
Exactly. It was just over 10. I'm sorry.
Was it liquid? A liquid biopsy? Because I know they can have a little higher TMBs.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, she had testing both on tumor and liquid, and she was both in that 11 to 12 range.
Interesting. What do you think, Peter?
I mean, my experience with TMB and immune therapy outside the TNBC patient group is limited, but also not overly positive. I don't think TMB is such a good predictor of your IO response in breast cancer compared to some of the other tumor types. Of course, it's an option that can be considered, but I'm relatively hesitant. On the other hand, I don't think anyone can say is SG better than TDXD in an ER positive patients. The studies are very different. And as you explained in your talk, the SG data were just at least one line later, actually 1 to 2 lines later in the majority of patients. And so I think these are both highly active drugs. And so therefore it's entirely reasonable to choose as you did SG and in there. I personally wouldn't prioritize immune therapy in ER-positive patients at the moment.
So also a question in the chat room from Adley, getting back to DB06, Sarah. If you do use TDXD in a patient after endocrine therapy, like what's next?
Yeah, no, good question. So if someone progresses on endocrine therapy, is HER2 low, and you give them TDXD first line, I would think about using what they didn't get so far, something like capecitabine or paclitaxel as a subsequent line of therapy. Certainly there's also sacituzumab govitecan, but I usually like to make sure they've had capecitabine or taxane before moving on to sacituzumab.
All right, so I want to move on now and talk about other ADCs, but here's a study looking at SASE plus IO. I guess the preliminary study, now there's a phase three, but interesting thing there that Sarah points out in her talk is you didn't really see a benefit overall, but when you use, I guess, CPS-01, it actually separated out. I mean, this is early data. We'll see if it plays out in the phase three trial, but it looked like when you looked at the CPS, maybe, using CBS1, and then other trials that you pointed out. We'll talk a little bit about Dato, but that combined with an IO, pretty impressive waterfall plot, similar trial going on with SASE. So the question, these are the two trials, I guess, that we're looking forward to see the answer to these questions to be determined. I think I'm going to skip this case right here. Anything you want to say, though, about Dato? Sarah, I guess the one question we hear about, and we hear this in lung cancer too, because, you know, they're looking at it as well, the mucositis that's seen there, it seems like that seems to be more prominent than some of the other ADCs.
It is really interesting to me, and I think Peter brought this up. It's funny that you can have ADCs that have the same target and also have Topo 1 payloads, but actually see different toxicity profiles, because we don't see much in the way of stomatitis with sacituzumab, but we do see quite a bit of stomatitis with datopotamab, and we don't see neutropenia with datopotamab, but we do with sacituzumab. So again, it's really interesting how the toxicity profiles are so different. I have found in my clinical experience with datopotamab deruxtecan that if I use the dexamethasone mouthwash, so I have them do the swish and spit four times a day, and I use it prophylactically before I even start someone on Dato-DXd, I find that it works very well. And so most patients either have no mucositis or will have very limited kind of low-grade mucositis if they're using the prophylaxis well. I know, Peter, you've certainly had a lot of experience too. I don't know how you've done with stomatitis.
So, obviously, in a very similar way, I think the steroid mouthwash is critical, and as is all other sort of mouthwashes you can bring in into play. However, I think there's a small group of patients that maybe as little as 5% who have a quite refractory stomatitis. And in those patients, we are not at the moment, I think, optimal in our management, and we'll still need to work out how we can manage those patients better. So for the majority of patients, it works really well. For the majority of patients, it's not a problem, and the stomatitis is easily manageable. But there is a small percentage of patients where, despite steroid mouthwash, we see significant stomatitis and then need to delay the treatment and reduce the dose.
I'll probably pick up the last 1 minute and play it for the lung people, because they're asking about this as well. We have another sacituzumab, SAC-TMT, an earlier phase development. Seems like pretty hard to tease out efficacy differences, but maybe tolerability at this point, Sarah? Any thoughts?
It's interesting. They presented a study that was almost identical to the ASCENT trial. They did SAC-TMT versus chemo of choice in a very similar setting and pretreated triple negative disease. And the data looked almost identical in terms of efficacy, in terms of both improvements in PFS and OS. But as you point out, toxicity profiles are slightly different. I think of SAC-TMT as kind of being a little bit in between sacituzumab govitecan and Dato-DXd, because it does have some neutropenia, maybe not quite as much as SG. It does have some stomatitis, not quite as much as Dato-DXd. So I think it kind of lives in between in terms of the different toxicity profiles.
So I know it's not ADCs, but it sounds like Uzoma could really use some help, Peter. We'll just flip this in very quickly. 47-year-old woman, T0N2, hormone receptor negative, HER2 positive, breast cancer, no response to three cycles of neoadjuvant TCHP. Any thoughts? I guess she's questioning, should they use something before surgery, like TDXD or TDM1, or just send the patient to surgery, but she needs some help. Would you like to provide it?
It's a tricky situation. It's quite unusual that patients with HER2 positive, ER negative, do not show any response. The first question I would always ask, does no response mean the cancer is just stable in size or shrinking a little bit, but not as quickly as we would like to? So unless there is disease progression, I personally would continue at this stage. Now, in Europe, we treat a little bit differently to the US, and I think we still use a fair amount of anthracyclines in the HER2-positive arena. And I think sometimes having a different chemotherapy backbone can be helpful. Obviously, if they already have been on HER2-targeted therapy, we are a little bit more anxious. But there are data out there say if you stop the HER2-targeted treatment, give some anthracyclines, that's not unreasonable. So if the patient isn't progressing, I possibly would continue for now. We in Europe wouldn't get away with switching to T-DXd at this point in time, as intriguing as it may feel, but I wouldn't do that.
So that sort of leads into this incredible slide, HER2-low. Would you like to comment a little bit on HER2-low, HER2-ultra-low, and where we're heading in that regard?
I mean, it looks much more beautiful when it's actually animated, because it's terribly confusing when you look at it in the unanimated way. But what I tried to demonstrate is where the HER2-positive versus HER2-negative comes from. And HER2-positive, as we said earlier, was really coined around the benefit of trastuzumab therapy. But that's overlapping, because trastuzumab, obviously being just an antibody, was also where HER2 was the oncogenic driver. And then we realized in the large group of patients who are not HER2 positive, there are patients with 2+, 1+ expression. They have no benefit from trastuzumab, but can have a benefit from trastuzumab deruxtecan in this. And that's about that. What the initial studies showed, HER2 1+, 2+ is about probably 2/3 of ER positive patients and about 1/3 of DNPC patients. Now we have this group here as HER2-0, and obviously, as we would these days say, HER2-0 is not one group, but has patients with a little bit expression, so HER2-0+ or ultra-low, and then HER2-null. And they, of course, show activity as well. I think what's in the right bottom corner of the slide is clinically quite important, and it is that if it's not HER2-high, the HER2 status can actually change very quickly. It can be patchy within tumors, so heterogeneous. If you take 3 biopsies, you have a much higher chance of finding HER2-low expression than if you just take 1 biopsy. But it can also change over time. Now, clinically, if your last biopsy is HER2-0, that's, in my opinion, irrelevant. If one of the biopsies was HER2-low, I would give HER2-targeted ADC therapy. So my summary here is HER2-low is a subgroup, but it's not a biological subgroup, because HER2 is actually, from a functional point of view, pretty irrelevant. It's not the oncogenic driver, but it is a fantastic anchor for ADC therapy. And therefore, we have a new therapeutic subgroup, not a biological subgroup.
So, Sarah, one of the things that's been interesting about T-DXd, I think people had the notion that this is a big molecule, it wasn't going to be helpful in brain mets, and seems like it is. I'm curious right now if you have a patient who has asymptomatic brain mets that you're going to use T-DXd on, would you hold off on radiation therapy, particularly with his whole brain?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. At first, when we thought about T-DXd, we thought it wouldn't get into the brain. And in fact, the original DB01 study didn't even allow patients with brain mets on because of that fear. But in fact, patients with brain mets really don't have an intact blood-brain barrier. And so I think these drugs are getting in nicely. And actually, what we're seeing in several trials is there is robust response in the brain, with response rates ranging between 40% to 70% with intracranial response. So very robust. And so, yes, if I had a patient who had several CNS lesions that might need whole brain radiation and also had systemic progression, I would feel comfortable with use of T-DXd. But that being said, our data sets are small, and it would be nice to see larger data sets with activity in the brain. And hopefully we'll see data soon from DESTINY-Breast12, which did have a large number of patients with CNS disease, and that hopefully will solidify these data.
So, Peter, again, would you treat a patient with T-DXd who was asymptomatic neurologically, who would require whole, people do this all the time with, EGFR, TKIs, et cetera, or would you give radiation therapy?
So, I think there are two things to consider. The first thing is if you give systemic therapy, it needs two points need to come together for the treatment to work. It needs to pass the blood-brain barrier, and it needs to be an effective drug. And we sometimes get a little bit obsessed with some molecules that may pass the blood-brain barrier really well, but are actually not very effective drugs. And trastuzumab deruxtecan is a highly effective drug in terms of response rate. Whether it passes the blood-brain barrier a little bit less than, for example, some of the TKIs is unclear, but you still bring a more effective drug into the brain. And therefore, I think it is, for me, still, even in patients with brain metastasis, my preferred option. The second question is around radiotherapy. Now, we give very, very little whole brain radiotherapy these days. And with good radiotherapy colleagues, we can treat the vast majority of patients with stereotactic radiotherapy, gamma knife. And so I'm not a great fan of leaving the brain untreated to just give systemic therapy. But I'm also wouldn't hardly ever have patients who have whole brain radiotherapy these days. If you look at the volume of the disease, the volume is relatively low. You can give stereotactic radiotherapy even with 30, 40, 50 small volume brain metastasis. And so I would, for me, it's not an either or, it's actually often a combination. And if you have substantial extracranial disease, then you want to see a response extracranially, possibly intracranially first with, let's say, T-DXd, but I would still consider a stereotactic radiotherapy.
30, 40, or 50, that's pretty interesting. So
there can be, Sarah, you see, that's obviously not in the guidelines. But
yeah, I was like, where did that come from?
Yeah. But you need to look at the overall volume of the, so obviously you can't do this with 42 centimeter lesions. So if you talk to the radiotherapy teams, they will say it's ultimately the treated volume is the key parameter. And if you have tiny little lesions, you can treat a relatively high number. But if it's, it comes down to the volume.
Interesting. Sarah, what about other ADCs, particularly trope-directed ADCs and CNS activity? What do we know about that?
Unfortunately, we have pretty limited data. There was some data presented by Andrew Brenner who had looked at sacituzumab in patients who had breast cancer-related brain metastases and did a really cool study where these were patients who were going to go to surgery to have resection of a CNS metastasis and gave sacituzumab prior to brain to their surgery and actually looked at drug levels in the tumor and in the CSF and found that it was very comparable to plasma. So it's obviously was getting there. And then I also followed these patients for response in lesions that weren't resected and did see that there were patients who had CNS response. It's a small set of patients though, and there is an ongoing study through SWOG in the United States that is enrolling patients who have CNS metastases, either hormone receptor positive or triple negative, and treating them with sacituzumab. And in fact, at our institution, there's also a study ongoing with Dato-DXd for CNS metastases. We saw a small set of data on Dato-DXd at ESMO Breast that also looked quite promising. So it does seem like TROP2 ADCs also have some CNS activity.
So let's get back to Destiny-Breast06. Peter, can you talk a little bit about HER2 ultra-low, which also seems to be not only effective, but I think in brain mets too. But anyhow, what about HER2 ultra-low?
Yeah, an interesting subgroup. That's obviously a subgroup that was classified as HER2 zero. It is within the IHC zero group, but these are patients who have between 1% and 10% of cells with faint or incomplete staining of the membrane. And I think the picture illustrates it here quite well. You see essentially one cell with a fair amount of HER2, possibly a lot of the tiny bit. And that seems to be enough to drive a benefit from treatment with trastuzumab deruxtecan, which is quite remarkable to consider. If possibly 98% of your cells haven't got the target and 1 or 2% of the cells have low activity. But the data are very impressive. They are entirely consistent between the HER2 low and the HER2 ultra low group. And I think that just demonstrates we either don't fully understand what we're doing, or the bystander effect is much more pronounced than we thought.
So, Sarah, any comments on Destiny-Breast06, both in HER2 low and ultra low?
One, I will say I found these data very impressive. You know, we didn't really even understand how chemo performs in a post-CDK4 setting. And so you see, you know, in fact, capecitabine or taxane does actually pretty well, right? The PFS is 8 months, but to beat it by 5 months in my mind is quite impressive, both in HER2-low and ultra-low. And well, I will say that the one caveat I will place on these data is there were only 150 patients with HER2-ultra-low. It was an exploratory kind of subgroup pre-planned analysis, but not actually powered for it. And I thought one intriguing finding was that degree of HER2 expression, at least in this study, may be impacting efficacy. Because if you looked at the HER2 2 plus patients in DESTINY-Breast06, their hazard ratio was around 0.5. But when you look at the 1 plus patients, it gets to be around 0.7 and a little bit not quite as good in the ultra low. And so, you know, they're kind of maybe some degree of benefit by HER2 expression. I think we'll have to see how that pans out further, maybe as we get more quantitative assays.
So this is a patient that Peter presented in his presentation. I just want to focus on the right side here, because this is a patient with who's ER positive, prior hormonal therapy, who ended up getting TDXD. Was HER2 low? Was it low or ultra low? But in any event, maybe you can talk a little bit about what happened when she was on the TDXD. It looked like she was on it for a while. And then I was really curious about this trial she went on. Speaking of your colleague, Dr. Powell's enfortumab vedotin in breast cancer. Glad to see that.
So, I mean, I think if you focus first on the TDXD time. So this is a patient, obviously, who meets very clearly the criteria of DB06. Ultra low expression, first line situation, and has a good response. What I find, well, and I don't know, Sarah, whether you see this as well, we see quite a bit of oligoprogression when we treat with ADCs, so a little bit with immune therapy as well, something we wouldn't have seen very much with classic chemotherapy in the past. And so if this was a patient with multiple liver mets and bone mets, but only one of the liver lesion and started progressing. And in that situation, we have, again, it's a data-free zone, but if you feel that the vast majority of the disease is controlled, I think it's not unreasonable to try a local therapy to that. And especially with the modern ways of giving radiotherapy, where you take care of someone who can use an MRI LINAC, where you don't need a fiducial anymore, where you have non-invasive radiotherapy to the site much easier than doing RFA, we can take that one lesion out very quickly. And that patient derived a benefit for another 6 months, which I think is pretty good.
That's great. How did she do in the enfortumab, particularly her skin?
Well, again, it's a learning curve. And if you speak to the GI team, they would say the same as we say about TDXD and SG. Initially, right, they struggled. Now they're quite good with managing the skin toxicity, and I'm not worried. But they may learn from us a little bit how to manage SG toxicity.
Absolutely. And then here's a graphic Peter discusses. I won't go through this. I think we've talked about side effects of TDXD a lot, including ILD. Just a couple other things related to TDXD I thought was interesting. I don't know how often you see HER2 mutant disease. Of course, you see that a lot in lung cancer. It looks like most people are open to using TDXD. Sarah, have you ever used it in a patient with HER2 mutation? Did you see a response, or you haven't seen it?
So I know actually, we do see HER2 mutations, particularly in ER-positive, HER2-negative disease, a little more common in lobular cancers, so somewhere between 2-5% have HER2 mutations. And we do have, you know, neratinib with fulvestrant and trastuzumab from the SUMMIT trial has data. But, you know, there is data from the pan-tumor DESTINY trial that focused on HER2 mutants and had about 100 patients, and I believe about 20% of patients had breast cancer, and they had about a 30% response rate. And so it seems like something that's worth trying. And we don't, you know, it's just a subset of that trial that had breast cancer, so we don't have very robust data, but I think reasonable to consider.
I think our interpretation is if you find a HER2 mutation, you must have the receptor somewhere. And that's why we thought these patients are probably ultra low and therefore still candidates for TDXD.
Yeah, I think a lot of them are actually HER2 positive. Interesting, too, both of you would try TDXD even with repeated IHC of 0. I won't get into it. This is an interesting slide about where you see things heading and whether you think that ADCs are going to land in the first-line setting. Sarah, you think an ER positive, I'm sorry, Peter, an ER positive. Sarah, you bring up triple negative. I think a lot of people would think maybe who knows both. Actually, you know what? Let's do this case. I really want to make sure we get feedback to Venue, even though it's not exactly on topic, but it sounds like something she could use some help with. So Sarah, she knows the program is on ADCs, but 41-year-old woman, 15 weeks pregnant with twins, scheduled for C-section in around December. History of Hodgkin lymphoma, treated with ABVD in 2000, and this is the real world, 2008, now presenting with clinically stage 2, T2N0, approximately 2.5 centimeter triple negative breast cancer, Ki-67 90%. Regarding staging scans, I'm thinking of doing a chest x-ray up with abdominal shield and ultrasound of the liver. Any other strategies? Her labs are pending with CA2729. Pembro is contraindicated, I'm just reading what she says, during pregnancy, thinking about doxorubicin and cyclophosphamide followed by paclitaxel, but she already got ABD for Hodgkin lymphoma, 300 per meter squared. Sarah, any thoughts?
Well, that's a tough case with the, you know, I think, and someone who's pregnant, generally speaking, we do try to use anthracycline-based therapy followed by taxane. I would agree. I would not use immunotherapy in a patient who's pregnant. I think here the complicating factor is just the total amount of anthracycline that she's had before. I would proceed with caution here, though, and I would try it with cardiac monitoring because, you know, it is probably the best regimen that we have. And so I think, you know, reasonable to consider here, but again, with caution. And we do have some safety data also of using single agent taxane through pregnancy as well. Our group has published some series about that. So I think ACT is usually what we would consider here.
Anything you would add to that, Peter?
I think we work a lot with the cardio-oncology team, and I think very proactive monitoring after each cycle of anthracycline AC-based therapy is critical with pro-BNP and TNT, and just see how those levels possibly trade. I think we have had a number of patients, not in the same case, but where we re-challenge with anthracycline. So two cycles are usually easy, straightforward. When it gets to cycle three or cycle four, it can be a little bit challenging. But if the cycles are given 3 weekly rather than dose stents, she will probably be already at early 30th week or so. And then one can think about a 34th weeks or so, a possible early delivery. And then post-surgery, I think she was, did you say she was triple negative? I would then give carboplatin and pembrolizumab post-surgery in that setting, knowing, of course, we are a little bit away from evidence.
So I know that Dr. Kona really appreciates his input. And we really appreciate you for teaching us so much today, Sarah and Peter. But for the audience, come on back tomorrow. I want to hear what Professor Peters and Professor Solomon have to say. You think adjuvant abemaciclib is kind of difficult. Let's talk about alectinib adjuvantly. We'll see how that goes for 2 or 3 years and when to use it and how it goes. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Sarah. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you.